Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles.
We're now going to look at the development of the theme that people cannot buy their way into or out of Sheol. Okay, Sheol, that's the key term. It's going to come up a few times, but that's really the focal point. Sheol is the grave. Okay, Sheol is where they believe everybody goes after they die. The notion of going, your soul going to heaven, it's not part of the ancient theology. Everybody goes to the grave. And that term is used 65 times in the Bible, and 16 of them are the Psalms.
Mm-hmm.
16 are the Psalms. Okay, and this is one of them. It's used three, four times, right? Okay. Now, a question, and all of you should answer this. How do I know that there are 65 times that this word Sheol appears in the Bible? Bible, don't say.
Because you trust your
Where do I find that?
That's with a C. Concordance.
Concordance.
Where do I find in the Bible?
Yeah, you told me not to say it. So Rick is my shaliach on this.
Do it. Concordance. It's a concordance. Remember, every single word is listed and they are numbered by the author of the concordance. This version of the concordance that I have, we talked about, it's all done on computer. It was done on computer. The original concordance, one guy did it. It took him years. Went crazy. This guy's the whole family did it. The kids, the father started it. He passed away. The kids finished it. It was done in a matter of a few years, all electronically. And there you go. Okay. Now, so I want to begin by showing you the first reference to Sheol. So you will now put a piece of paper in the Psalms where we are. And go to Genesis chapter 37. And I want you to look at verses 31 to 35. Genesis, Bereishit 37, Lamed Zion, verses 31 to 35. So somebody just summarize what it is that we are, what is this, what's happening here in 25 words or less.
Well, this is when Jacob finds out that his son has died.
Yes.
It appears to, because of the blood on the coat.
Exactly.
That's on the tunic. And he says...
I'll look at verse 35.
Yeah, I'm going to go... It's so horrible, I'm going to go down mourning into Sheol.
Right. That's right. I'm going to go down mourning my son into Sheol. And he could not be comforted by his children, by the remaining children. Okay? So he anticipates he's going to go. He's saying he knows he's going to Sheol eventually, but the point is he will not go happy into Sheol. He's going to go down grieving because this loss is so huge for him. Okay. Yes, Bert?
Is it the body that goes down to Sheol or the soul or both?
Well, the soul, it dissipates, it goes away. It's the body is down there. There's not a lot of discussion if the soul goes down there.
Okay.
I mean, they talk about, Job talks about this. Okay. And they talk about how miserable it is down there, but they don't, I don't necessarily think
there was sick. There was Samuel, Rabbi?
Yeah, well, Samuel is pulled up, right? But that's
by Saul, something like that.
Yeah, but he's there personally, physically. That's magic, okay? And that technically, after the Torah was given, that would be forbidden. You cannot, witches, right? The witch of the infamous witch of Ein Dor, right? Witches they're supposed to be killed because they believe in powers over which they have control. And that's totally antithetical to the fact that only God controls these things. Okay, so it's not the notion of what is the spiritual makeup of the human being, what's their physical makeup down there. Today, later on, you're going to see that the assumption is in this psalm that the body falls apart. It decomposes. It says so. They knew that because they saw what happened above ground, right? They had enough experiences watching, seeing dead bodies, given plagues, given wars, whatever. And so they knew that they decomposed, but how that happens, we don't know. Yeah. So he says in verse 6, the cause of evil that I'm feeling that, is around me, which I don't hear, it says in verse 6. So he says, the people who rely on their riches and who assume it's a sarcastic statement that they think that they really think that they have some lasting power, that it's meaningful, that it, frames themselves for their wealth. They think this is meaningful. Right? Now it's going to be taken. Right? So it says, "Ach lo pada yifte ish v'lo yiten l'Elohim kofro." Right? A person cannot redeem another person or pay his ransom to God. Okay? All right. You can't do that. You cannot redeem them from what's going to happen to them after they die. Doesn't say yet, but it's pointing, it's building up. Eventually a word will come up later, just soon, that refers to what it is. And it's not, interestingly, it's not Sheol. The reference to Sheol, it sort of builds up with this obscure, this very unclear statement where they're going, to another word, shachat, which we'll see in a minute. And then later on, it says sheol. So I find that fascinating that it's not mentioned obliquely, and then finally the real thing hits you. All right, is that artistry? Is that poetry? Could be, given the structuring here, the use of terms, the way things are laid out, I wouldn't be surprised if it was the brilliance of the author. To string you along, keep you, well, where are they going? What is this place? You don't know for sure. And finally, he lays it on you. All right, so that's what this is saying. So the point is, but look at the first word, ach with a chet. What does it mean? What's an ach?
Anybody? But, B-U-T, ach.
Huh?
But, chet. B-U-T.
Huh?
Aleph chaf. Chet.
No,
Aleph chet is brother.
Brother, right.
Yeah.
So this here, it's interpreting a comrade. Siegel says comrade. The JPS says a man. It's like saying a brother cannot redeem another one. A brother meaning someone, a friend. It could be a friend, a comrade, whatever. So person X cannot redeem person Y. Okay? That's what these seems to say. But I do not think I do not think that a person that could mean that. I would say it means surely or alas. In other words, it's like Aleph Chaf Sofit. Aleph Chaf, okay, Aleph Chaf is the normal way you say that or you'd spell it. But there are times when the chet takes that place. And if you look in the dictionary in particular, it will note the fact that that's the case. If you look in the concordance, ach is something, he says in Hebrew, oi. It means, ach means oi. Okay. But in this, so you could say oi. Okay. I don't think it means a person. I think it means the same as Aleph Chaf. And the dictionary says it means surely. So I think it means, it's saying the same point, but it's just saying it differently. Surely, indeed, one cannot redeem a person, right? One cannot redeem a person from what awaits them, because you can't pay his ransom to God. You cannot pay his ransom to God. It's impossible for you to do that. Okay? So, then he says, basically what you have here is the two pieces of the verse. The first one is like an apodictic statement. This is the fact. This is the reality. You cannot redeem another person. Why? Second part. Because you cannot pay God. You can't buy out God. Doesn't work. God doesn't work that way. So he slams the door. Okay? He slams the door on you. Got it? That's what's going on here. And that no, it's a categorical statement at the end. You just can't do that. Can't buy God. Can't buy him off. What he has in store for you after you die, that's the way it is. Doesn't say yet what it is, right? But that whatever it is, that's the way it is. Okay, Tybel.
But also, I mean, I thought we were talking about death, and it seems to me you can't redeem yourself either.
Yes, of course. You can.
Okay, I'm just making sure.
You could take it either. A person cannot redeem themselves. All it says is one cannot redeem a person. Doesn't say who the redeemer is, whether it's you to yourself, or in other words, you couldn't pay off God, or somebody else couldn't pay off God. It's not clear. Okay. And that's right. Yes. All right. Why? Verse 9. V'yekar pidyon nafsham v'chadal la'olam. Okay. What does that mean? The redemption of their being, of their soul, but here, yeah, but not, nefesh does not mean a spiritual thing. Nefesh here means, we'll talk about it in a moment, your being alive, the life force that animates your body. It's not a soul, a spiritual entity with special powers, right? I mean, later on, and even at a certain point, even in the Bible, the soul was seen to, was understood to be the source of thought, the source of emotions, and it was in the heart. But this doesn't even say that. This is simply saying the life force within. So it means then you cannot pay enough to get that life force, the ransom fee. For that life force is yakar. It's too expensive. Okay? And what Siegel says it beautifully, the redemption of their soul being too precious. And so one ceases to be forever. Chadal. Cease to be forever. That's it. When you die, you cease to be. Categorical. That's the whole point. But this term, yakar, keep it in mind. We're going to come back to that. Today, yakar means if you have a jewel, a diamond, okay, big, beautiful, class A diamond. Oh, ze yakar meod. That's a very expensive diamond. Has that same meaning. Yakar can mean dear, right? Dear, close to you. Yakirati, my dear one, my beloved, you know, yakar. Yes, Suzanne.
It seems to me that this has the double meaning through the double meaning of the word ikar, in that something you might most want to be able to do with money, you can't do. And whether it's too expensive, whether it's so close and yet too far from your power.
Okay, it's interesting. Yeah, very, very well could be. But the point we're going to see later on is overall theme. it deals with rich, with wealth. Okay. That term is popping up in the context of wealth. Remember, because his whole point is a wealthy person, you know, remember already in verses 6 and 7, the evil that was facing him came from rich people. Okay. It's almost these, as we said, remember last time, it's like in the Christian Bible with the camel through the eye of a needle and a rich person, that whole statement. Okay. Tybel.
The community that Betham sometimes combines with Ikar, which they on their website say Ikar means essence. I assume that's the same root.
No, it's with an ion.
Got it.
Ion, a different word. Yeah. Now let's talk about nefesh for a moment. Okay. So I say it's not a, I'm reading my notes. Okay. It's not a spiritual essence that can be reunited with the realm of, the realm of divine existence, like the neshama, right? The way the rabbis use the term neshama. Here it means the animating force that allows a physical body to operate. So open up your Bible to Genesis chapter 1. That's easy to find. It's at the front of the book. I'm joking.
Yeah, yeah. What verse?
20:21. The term nefesh chaya.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It means a living being. It talks about the capacity to be physically alive. So the soul, the point is, you cannot continue physical life in any form after you die. It's gone.
Would that be similar to saying like the breath of life?
Yeah, in a sense.
It's a metaphor.
Yes. Well, remember, now look in Genesis chapter 2, verse 7. This is from the second story of creation.
Yishma chayim.
Yeah. Right? And it says,
the nefesh chaya at the end.
Nishmat means breath of life. Nashom nun shin mem and nun fei shin both have to do with breathing, by the way. So there you see it. That's so when God blows the breath of life, and when you die, what happens?
Goes away.
The breath of life leaves. And they thought that literally, because if you've been present for that horribly sad moment when a person dies, very often there's that moment when you hear
death rattle, they say. Yeah.
Whatever, however it sounds. Yeah. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't.
It's also interesting that we don't breathe willfully in most cases.
Right. It's automatic.
You could say God given. I mean, the fact that we even exist, that we can go to sleep and wake up in the morning, yeah, and, you know, we don't have to tell ourselves to breathe. Although there is a part of our brain, for those of us who have sleep apnea, you know.
When I wake up, I don't think about it. I take
no,
you know, because it's up here. This guy's running it, you know.
Well, or that guy.
Well.
Metaphor.
Directly or indirectly. I mean, I don't know. Well, you know that there is this notion, shechazarta b'nishmati b'chemla, you return my soul to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there is this thought that when you die, and you don't know what's going on in the world, you know, I'm sorry, when you fall asleep.
Right.
What's going on, you die. You're dead. But, you know, but if there's a big alarm, suddenly I wake up. I mean, that, you know, the alarm causes God to blow into me, so I wake. I don't want to go there. Anyhow, so that's the point here, all right? So nasham, neshama also comes from the word breath, and that's just another word. Okay. All right. So this explains basically why you can't buy God. All right. And then it goes on. Now you have a rhetorical question. This is the second rhetorical question. 6-7 was the first rhetorical question. Do these guys really think that they can do what they wanted, that, you know, that their wealth gives them special powers? Okay, that was 6 and 7. Now you have another rhetorical question. Shall he live eternally? Lo yireh ha-shachat. He will never see the pit. Notice what it says. It doesn't say Sheol yet. It says shachat, the pit. Okay? A deep hole. All it is saying now is that when you die, you go into a deep hole. Well, in physically, yeah, that's the grave, right? So you could say that's the grave. But he uses, it's interesting. Siegel chooses this and gives up the P in pit, a capital P, meaning it's not just any old pit. It's a pit. Now, once he goes underground and you bury, he really goes down further and ultimately ends up down there. Okay? So, but this is what I said before. It's a step in the direction toward Sheol, which we're not going to see until verses 15 and 16. Okay? When they get there. All right. And now he goes on. Ki yireh chachamim yamutu, yachad ksil uba'ar yovedu, ve'azvu l'acheri mechelam. For one sees that the wise die, that the foolish and ignorant both perish, leaving their wealth to others. So they die, and everything they worked on, they can't take it with them. It's exactly the point. Right? They just can't, you can't take it with you. Now we're going to see it's more complicated than that. It's more complicated than that. Exactly what are these people thinking about? All right? Now here we have the word ksil, which means a fool, a foolish person. All right? Keep that in mind because that concept's going to pop up again. Okay? And this is now laying the groundwork or something very interesting. Okay, this notion here is going to set the theme, the tone, for the next number of verses. But before we go, as Rabbi Siegel notes, and others have noted, this sounds like Kohelet, Ecclesiastes. It sounds like Kohelet. So now I want you to get your Bible and open up to the back, where you find the five scrolls, right? Shirashirim, etc., Esther, and you have Kohelet. That's the one we read on Sukkot. All right? Kohelet. Take your time. Not too much.
What verse, sir?
We're going to look at verses 14 through 16.
Kisil, I see.
Right there. Right, exactly. All right? 14 to 16. So, a wise man, I'll read the English. A wise man has his eyes in his head, whereas a fool walks in the darkness. And that verse, Hachacham einav b'rosho v'ksil b'choshech holech. So it seems, oh, you see, I have an advantage. I can see things. I pay attention. The fool walks in darkness. Hooray for me. Right. But then he says, V'yadati ki ani Gamani, Shemikre Echad Yikrebech et Kulam. But I also realize the same fate awaits them both. Be'amarti ani believe, and I said in my heart, Kimikre Aksil Gamani Yikremi. Right? Whatever, the same thing that happens to the fool happens to me. The fate of the fool is destined for me. Right? And to what advantage then have I been wise? Came to the conclusion that this too was futile. Okay, because the wise man, just like the fool, is not remembered forever. For as the succeeding days roll by, both are forgotten. Alas, the wise man dies just like the fool. All right? So there you got it.
It's a bit dark.
But that's the Ecclesiastes. Yeah. That's him. And you're going to see later on that the discussion here is not going to deal only with, you know, going down to Sheol. It will deal with this remembrance, with, you know, Will you remember me? Will this, you know, will there be something that keeps permanent my presence in this world in some fashion? And of course, the answer that the psalmist is going to tell us is no. The same way that Kohelet says the same thing. Because according to tradition, who was Kohelet?
Solomon,
it was Shlomo HaMelech, right? And when did he write Kohelet? How old was he? He was old, right? I think I said this last time, right? He wrote Shir HaShirim, love poetry, when he was young, according to tradition. He wrote Mishlei, right? Proverbs, when he was wise and mature. And when he got old and he looked around and he realized what a mess everything was, he said, ain't no difference between me and everybody else. We're all going to end up dead. That's it. Yeah.
So how does this end up being, I mean, this may be a bad aside here, but how does this end up being our sacred literature when it's so dark, and you read this and you say, well, so what? So why be good? Why, you know, it doesn't make any difference. We all die anyway, which sounds just so unquote religious or un-Jewish or.
Exactly. And the fact is, the decision what books to keep in the Bible wasn't made till the time either of the late Pharisees or the early rabbis. Okay. Yes. I mean, Rabbi Akiva was the one, according to tradition, who ensured that Shir HaShirim would go in. Because that's all sex. And everybody who knows it understands that a lot of the metaphors there are dealing with the sex act. The garden. The locked garden. The chastity belt. Okay. But it says explicitly, your neck is like this, your breast is like that, your belly is like this, you know, your legs. I mean, there's vivid descriptions of the man is saying about the beautiful woman's body. It's like he's, you know, showing it on you.
But wasn't that interpreted as being about God? A justification?
So Rabbi, according to tradition, said this is the love relationship between God and Israel. And that, according to tradition, that's what kept it in. All right. The fact is, why are they there? Because number one, because the traditions developed that men, mostly, who were filled with the divine spirit, right? Who were Nevi'im, who had the power of Nevuah, some form of prophetic power, deep understanding from God. So included David and Samuel and Solomon. Remember, according to the rabbis, prophecy ended with Malachi around the year, more or less, 400 BCE. He's the last prophet. After that, there's no more prophecy. That's what the rabbis said. It's in the rabbinic sources. All right? So the point is, these people were imbued. So what the answer would be, from a traditional perspective, so this is David. Right? Because David wrote the Psalms. Actually, this is B'nai Korah, right? But they're mentioned as having been around in biblical times. And the fact that this became sanctified means that in some fashion they were filled with some kind of divine spirit from God that gave them the capacity to understand these things, right? And so, given the fact that these all were written before the prophet Malachi, they have sanctity. And look at the book of Esther. God's not even mentioned. Not even mentioned. Okay. The point, and what the thing is that these were books that resonated one way or another with the people. So rather than fighting this tendency that people have to have all kinds of things there, they said, fine. Why is it there? God knows. Or, why is it there? Because each one of these books in their own way deals with a real part of life. Is the sex act part of life? Yes, it is. Should it be beautiful? Yes, it should. So the rabbis would say, and the ancients would say, under what circumstances? When you get married, right? Marital sex is amazing. That's the point. Do we find moments of frustration where things make us wonder, is there any meaning to life? Kohelet says that, right? Because sometimes I feel like I'm doing something, right? And in fact, I'll never, there's a story, the true story. A young man went to visit one of the Hasidic rabbis in Mea Shearim, well-known guy who just, his door was open all the time. People from all walks of life would come in and ask him questions and talk. He was known as a very open and wonderful person, a real tzaddik. So this young man comes in and he looks around and he says, you know, Rabbi, I'm looking at all these books that you've read and you know and you understand. He says, you must have answers for everything. And he says, you know what? The more I read, the more questions I have. And apparently this actually happened. That rabbi was so totally honest, right? Because life is so totally complicated. It's filled constantly with contradictions. And so by having all these books in, they say, yes, indeed, this is reality. But there's enough response in all these things, that, but you still have to have faith, right? And you don't understand everything in the world, right? And this, in a sense, it falls into that category. So I think that's the answer. I'm thinking historically, that's what happened. And that makes perfectly good sense. Why is there contradictory creation accounts? There's no question if you read it with an open mind. They're totally contradictory. God created. That's basically all they have in common. In one, God does everything perfect. In the second one, he makes a couple of mistakes. Right? In one, the man and the woman are created together. In the other, the woman doesn't come around until the second chance. Right? First, God's second mistake was he created the animals instead of a woman. Finally, God realized the way I can, now I know how to do this. Looks at the end, takes it out of Adam. Okay. But the point is, everybody knew. Anybody who told those stories and they were brought together understood that they're differences. So they're seen as complementary. That's the ultimate answer. And the point is, the reality is that both phenomena exist in the world, right? God can be the God of Genesis 1. What does God say at the end of Genesis 1? What does he tell the man and the woman? The man and the woman, not just the man. What does he say to the pair? What does he say?
Doesn't he say be fruitful and multiply?
And rule.
Oh.
And the being fruitful and multiply is so they can rule because the animals will outnumber them. Remember, most of these people were shepherds. There's one shepherd, a couple of sheepdogs, right? And everything else is sheep, right? Okay. So the point is that, but what does God say? You rule. What about God? So he's saying he is the general. We're the lieutenants. Okay, guys, you rule. Come and see me, you know, if you need some big things, but basically you're in charge. So he backs off, right? Genesis chapter 2, where's God? He's walking in the garden, right? He's there, present. But where is God? Distant or close? What's the answer? The answer is yes.
Both and.
Yes. And by having the two stories, she said, but that's a contradiction. Yes, it is. Because you think you understand God. No, you're a pea-brain human. That's it. Live with it. Okay, and that's the message. It's true. And sometimes you need to believe that God is this powerful force that runs the universe. But you can't help but saying that because you just see these amazing things going on and you're just totally awestruck, where you realize when you send something out into space and it turns off, right, and the probe that you're sending out to Mars breaks down and you can't learn a thing about Mars. It takes 3-4 times until you get something out there. Finally, you learn something. Then finally say, look, that clearly that's a challenge. God doesn't have to worry about things breaking down. Okay, this is an amazing process up here. But sometimes you don't want to think cosmically. I need God to comfort me. I'm in great pain, emotional pain, spiritual pain, physical pain. Help. Hug me. Give me a kiss. Help. Heal me. Whatever. You want to close God. So it's there. That's reality. And so that's why it's all there. And so, yes, the answer is yes. All right, moving on. So now this is a fascinating and a very confusing statement. There are answers to this. Okay, we're going to really work on it. Here we go. Kirvam batemo la'olam. Okay. Mishkanotam l'dor vador. Karu bishmotam alei adamot. This is a three-part, not a two-part thing. Three distinct parts. All right. What's kirbam? Okay. Many, many people read that word as kivram, their grave. Okay. The resh and the bet were flipped accidentally. It's a mistake. The scribe wrote it wrong. There are times when that seems to be most obvious. A lot of people think this is obvious because what does kirbam mean? Kirbam kerev means the inside. Okay, something inside, something close. It has nothing to do with the grave. Harov means close. Kerev means within, the inside of you. Okay? So some people say it means kirbam batemo la'olam. Their grave is their house forever. See, we're getting closer to Sheol now, yes? Their grave is their house forever. That makes perfectly good sense. By the way, batemo, that's one of those archaic endings. It should be betam, right? Or batehem. Batemo is an archaic ending. That's what leads me to think that maybe this is an old psalm, old Hebrew, all right? Mishkanotam l'dor v'dor. They think, right? So it is that their that grave is their dwelling place forever. Talking about the grave. Karuvish motam alei adamot. Okay. Yet they thought of themselves that they would exist. You know, Karuv, and yet they called out their name on earth. Called out their name in the sense they said, ah, oh, my name, it's going to last forever. My name, ha ha. No, this is what we said before, that the Kohelet said nothing stays. Kohelet mentioned there's not even a remembrance of you. So that last line is saying they're fools. This is talking about the fools because it says their whatever, their kerev or their grave. This is talking about the person referred to in the previous verse. And one of clearly the main person there, we'll see why in a few verses, was the fool. The fool believes this. In fact, though, their grave is going to be their home and will be their dwelling place. And they call out their name on earth and they think that's going to be forever. No, they're fools. That's what this is saying. All right. Now, an alternative, though, and this is what Siegel says, and I tend to agree with it. It says, don't change it. Don't make a correction and have it be grave. It's kirbam. Their innermost self believes that their house will be there forever. Their house. Their batemo means beitam. Their house will be l'olam, forever. That's what they think. And they think Mishkanotam l'dor v'dor. And it'll be their dwelling place from generation to generation. that somehow their presence will continue to be present in their home, right? And they call out their name. This is going to be the, this will be the Schwartz home. Schwartz will be here forever. Living, dead, he'll be here. His remembrance, some vestige of him. I'm not going to be gone. In other words, these fools think that there's some eternal element that will survive after they die, because they really won't die. That's what he's saying. Okay. I like that because I think it hits right to the point. And it's there, the fools. It's talking, that's that. I told you, keep that word in mind. All right. And it continues in the next one too. All right. Okay. All right. Tybalt, question.
Sorry, I hope it's okay. It's a comment. When you were just talking about that, I was reminded about some of the archaeological findings about when wealthy Jerusalemites started doing rock-cut tombs rather than the way poorer people were buried, or, say, people were buried in the Galilee or other places, just this notion of the rock cut being more permanent.
Yes. Well, how about this? If you've been to Beit Sha'arim in Israel?
Yes.
Right? The cave, the burial cave, that's a kosher grave, right? It's because it's burial in the ground, even though it's a big room built into the side of a mountain, right? That's considered burial in a grave. If you put a mausoleum on the side of a hill, it's kosher. They've done that in Israel. The Rabbanut said that's okay. In Jerusalem, because it's hilly, they have to build it into the side of the mountain, and that's kosher. Effectively, each grave is separate, but still, it's the same thing. If they're not going deep into the ground, all right. So anyhow, if you go in, what do you see? Among other things, beautiful marble sarcophagi, right? Greco-Roman style sarcophagi. And on some of them are names, Hebrew names. Hebrew name. I see your hand light, just a second. Okay. And they appear to be names of the family of the leader of the Jewish community. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, he's not buried there. But that family, you know, that began with Gamliel and Shimon ben Gamliel and Yehuda HaNasi, they became political hacks. They moved further and further away from being scholars, learned people. I mean, even Shimon ben Gamliel and Gamliel himself, these are the two people who preceded Yehuda HaNasi. Gamliel in the generation after the destruction, and his son Shimon ben Gamliel, and then Yehuda HaNasi is Yehuda ben Shimon. Okay? Those are the first three generations. The first two were not the smartest guy around, and they knew it. Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi is the only one who really gave evidence of true scholarship. And that's why he could produce the Mishnah, because people respected him not just as the leader, the political leader, but because he was a scholar. And after him, things began to diminish. So this is from some of the later generations when they were political people. But there, in those sarcophagi were their remains. They're gone now. I mean, either somebody took them out, centuries ago, or they just became dust. I don't know. Nobody knows. But they were buried in these. If you want to talk about a physical presence, you could go into the cave and see them, in these beautiful, magnificent sarcophagi. I mean, today we encourage people use a plain pine box, right? Why do you want to be buried in a very expensive, people could see you in this very expensive box for an hour before you go down, right? It's just the opposite that we push for. But there they were. Okay, Mike.
Yes, it seems to me that in some Siddur that we've used in the past, this paragraph 12, is it 12? Yeah, was translated something like the foolish name their estates after themselves, put their name on their house.
That's the last one. Yeah. That's it. Yeah, remember I said this is the Schwartz place.
Right.
Yes, that's what the last part means. Yeah, exactly. Right. Good. Okay. So this there's a term that both Rabbi Siegel and I learned from Rabbi Professor Robert Gordas, who was a wonderful Bible scholar and also at the same time a congregational rabbi in Far Rockaway, New York. And of course, David Gordas, Danny Gordas, David is his son, Danny is his grandson by another son. The name is, there are three generations there of Gordases who have a reputation, you know, very good reputation surrounding them. Anyhow, so he told us that he taught us Bible. We studied with him the Chamesh Megillot, the five scrolls. And he told us about this. I learned this term, difficilior lectio, the difficult reading, the more difficult reading. And sometimes he says, sometimes that is the original one. And the reason why you can assume that is because the one just fits in too simply. It works too smoothly. The original one could be the right one. And our job is to figure out what that actually means. So that's what's going on here in a sense. And I think I didn't ask Benji whether that's in fact the case. He doesn't mention that, but I think that's what's in his head. And I appreciate that. Okay. Anyway, what I found interesting here is that Adin Steinsaltz, in his comment, the great Adin Steinsaltz, you've heard of Adin Steinsaltz? Okay, his Talmud was a bestseller. I mean, it's the original Babylonian Talmud, but, you know, it was translated into English. You'd go, Sepharia. Open up Sepharia. You will find the Talmud. And the translation is the English version of the Hebrew commentary that Steinsaltz, may he rest in peace, developed. Okay. Steinsaltz is an interesting guy. He was raised in Israel, Shomer HaTzair. Communist, socialist, extreme left wing. Pagans. I mean, atheists. And end up being a Chabad rabbi who didn't identify himself so much as that, but he was a Lubavitch. Brilliant, amazing Talmud scholar, pious, super pious Jew. He went like this. My professor at UCLA, Amos Funkenstein, may he rest in peace, went in the opposite direction. His father was an Orthodox rabbi, not a Hasid. He ended up an atheist because his mind could not figure out a clear proof of the existence of God. And he was totally in his mind. Man was brilliant. He was a genius. I mean, literally a genius. But they knew each other. They knew each other. And their paths crossed like that. Fascinating. And they respected each other because they both have brilliant minds, had brilliant minds. Anyway, so Steinsaltz says something, almost the same thing that Benji Siegel says. I got to ask him, did he read Steinsaltz here? If he did, he would have mentioned it, but I don't think he was. All right, anyhow. All right, moving on. Now, a very, very important verse, 13. All right. The Adam Bikar Bal Yalim Nimshal Kabehemot Nivmu. Benji Siegel, I like what it means. A man does not go down with precious things. He is like the beasts that perish. Remember I told you about Yakar above, right? That precious, that your body, redeeming your body, redeeming yourself from Sheol, it's too precious, it's too expensive, too costly. Same thing here. A man does not go down. Not go down means die. Go down to the grave. Yalim. Yalim means to go to sleep at night. And he's right. It's a metaphor for dying. Like we said before, right, when we were chatting at the beginning, you go to sleep at night, you think you die. That whole notion. All right, that's what it's called. That's what it is. you don't with precious things that happens. I mean, you know, you can't bring all the precious things down with you to Sheol. You can't. Okay. Now, again, Sheol is not mentioned, but we already had the word Shachat, grave. We know this is where it's heading. So you can't bring these things down with you. Why? He's like the beasts that perish. When you die, a wealthy person who has precious things surrounds himself with precious things. No, you can't take him with you because you're going to be just like the beasts. You're no different from the animals. They have a nefesh in them, a nefesh chaya. You have a nefesh chaya. Their nefesh chaya goes away. Your nefesh chaya is going to go away. At least they die. You can see them lying dead on top. You die. At least when you die, you're going to go down. Okay, you don't have to. Everybody doesn't have to see you naked falling apart on earth on top. All right, so that's what it means. And I think the point is, why is that here? Where do you put your precious things? In your house. This is a continuation. It's the fool about whom we read in verse 11. Again, the same thing here. The wealthy fool is the guy who thinks he can take all these wonderful things from his house down with him. He can name the house that'll stay forever. And the stuff inside, you can put it in his grave. Think about it. The fact is, people were buried with precious things, weren't they? The pagans did that, right? So this is, in a sense, it's very interesting. He says, no, they got it wrong. You can't go down there and have a feast. You know, the Egyptians used to send food down when they buried, right? Because the god needed to be sustained. And they all kind of jewelry and all kinds of stuff went down. Big whoopee, this is saying. No, doesn't work. Okay. All right. First, Rick, then Tybal.
Hi. So I see that there's a parallel to the end, the same three words at the very end.
Yes.
Well, but the there is velo yavin instead of velo yalin.
I'm not going to explain that now. You're dead, but I will come to the right. No, the last line almost repeats this. The very last line of the psalm. Yeah.
By design. Yes.
By design.
Okay.
By design.
I'll stop there then. I just had to ask.
Well, I'm glad. No. I don't mind. I'm just saying I will discuss that at greater length later. Okay. All right, Tybal.
The thing about, I keep hitting the wrong button. The thing about when you just said buried with things, wasn't that whole Egyptian thing, not just even with objects, but with food, like
I said that, yes.
Oh, sorry. I don't know. I must have missed it, but it also reminded me of some
odds. Yeah, they had
some American excesses where celebrities get buried in their rare cars. You know, they're vintage automobiles. I mean, celebrities who in theory are Christian, but that's more, I think, a thumbing nose at people like, look what I got and I'm taking it with me.
That's right. That's right. But the Brinks truck doesn't go down. It's too big. All right. Yeah. I've heard about that one. That's so funny. All right. Anyway, but here's the thing. Benji Siegel thinks that this is the end of the first part of this whole discussion. I have a problem with that because look at verse 14. Zedar kam kesalamo, b'achareihem b'fihem yirtzu sela. Okay, translation. Such is the fate of the foolish, yet their mouth, they express desire for what awaits them. In other words, They look at what awaits them when they die, and they say, "Ooh, I can't wait," because what? They're fools. I can't wait for what comes later, assuming what comes later is going to be better than what was. All right. So that's the, and here's the word kesel. It's the same as kasil, a fool. Kessel is foolishness. All right, Zedar kam kessel lamo. That literally it means this is their way, dash, those to whom foolishness belongs. And lamo means lahem, to them, right? And that is that's an archaic Hebrew word. Another one. All right. Now, what's the last word of that verse? Selah. Selah, we may have talked about that. I don't remember. Selah is a strange word. It means, it either is a, I see your hand, Bert, just a second. Selah can mean like a pause. It can be a musical note that maybe implies a going up, but somehow it means this is a stop. It could be a pause. Okay, but it's sort of, it's a concluding verse. You know, it's like you hear when some sopranos or some tenors sing the national anthem, or the land of the free.
Oh,
that's a selah. It causes everybody to go, right? That's a selah.
And so a high point.
That's the pausing point. And this is the end. I remember I told you there were four verses, 11 through 14, 11, 12, 13, 14, dealing with the pool. This is the end. I'm going to say, I'll come and tell Benji about this. In fact, this is the where the subsection on the pool ends. So 11 to 14, it's the kessel, the words of foolishness are the frame. You have Kassil in 11, Kessel here, and that means everything in between is talking about the fool who thinks he can use his wealth to somehow perpetuate himself after he dies. That's what that is. Make sense? I think absolutely. But of course, it's my idea. All right, Bert.
I was just going to say... That the translation, the JPS translation here, doesn't have fool. It says who are self-confident.
I don't understand that. It is wrong. I don't get it.
Okay. Although one could say that someone who is over self-confident is a fool, but there's nothing in the Hebrew that you see that says self-confident.
I don't know.
Ah, that makes two of us.
Yeah, I don't. Okay. I have no idea. All right. And this notion, wait a second. I see your hand type, just a minute. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, that last line, Befiham Yirtzu, Selah. And it may mean that they desire, Haim Rotzim, they say, Befiham, with their mouth, they talk about how much they like, they're looking forward to the end of their lives. I think that's what that means. Okay. And I agree with Benji on that. Okay. All right, Tybel.
But you don't link the first phrase in 15 to the previous? Because aren't the fools the ones that are like sheep?
Oh, the next one. Yeah. It could be, that continues on. But on the other hand, it's very possible. But all I'm saying here is that term doesn't pop up again. The word kassil or kessel does not reappear. So he could be jumping back to the original notion that don't, not necessarily fools, but or yes, or you could be right. By placing it where it is sort of in the middle here, it may mean this is exactly what we're talking about. These foolish people, everything I said before about these people who think they're wealth, and everything he's going to say afterwards now about this people and their wealth, they're fools. It could be, yes, what you're suggesting, I would not reject out of hand. Okay? Yeah. So it could. I haven't thought about it. But the fact of where it's positioned, right, it's 11 to 14. So you're starting there with verse 7, right, as the bridge verse, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 to 14, and you got 15 through 21. Yeah, it's sort of positioned in the middle. And you could easily say this relates to everything that came before it, and it relates to everything that came afterwards, because that's why it's in the middle. I'll buy it. Good. Thank you. See, that's why I have all you guys in this class. You're such brilliant people. Now with the sheep. Oh, yes, yeah, sorry. That's it. Moving along. Verse 15. Oh, my God. Katzon lishol shatu. Okay. Sheep-like. They head for Sheol. There it is, folks. We finally arrived. Here it is. Okay, they are like sheep who are heading toward Sheol. Mavet yiram. Death will be their shepherd. Ooh. Yiram. Ro etzon, resh ayin hey, a shepherd. A shepherd yiram means the shepherd will lead them.
Death. It's the opposite of Psalm 23.
Exactly. Right. The Lord is my shepherd. Yes. I shall not want. Exactly. Very good. All right. Moving on. I see your hand. Let me move ahead, Tybel. Hold on. Okay. V'yirdu bam yesharim laboker. I'm not quite clear on what this means. It means that upright people will rule them in the morning. Who are the upright people? Yashar means an upright person. So they're going to be, it says, okay, Yerdubam, they will rule them. Who were the Yasharim will rule them in the morning. Now, maybe that means that, I don't know what it means. Steinsaltz in his commentary suggests it may refer to angels, okay? Or he suggests, one second, I'm looking at it now. It may be, he's saying, maybe it means that they will rule in the sense they will now rule all of his possessions that he leaves behind. But I like better that it may refer to angels, because the fact that angels get assignments of different kinds and they do tasks that God, you know, assigns to them. So some of them are sent down below to make sure that these people, when they get down there, do what they're supposed to do, which is die, be dead, and maybe gives us an inkling that maybe there's some vestige, leftover vestige of spirit of nefesh chaya in them, you know, and they just should shut up. And then how does it end? V'tzuram levalot sheol mizvul lo. And their form will continue to, will rot. I like Steinsaltz on this. Hold it. Let me just take a look. Right. Because it says, zvul means like a palace, a big building. Okay. So what Steinsaltz suggests is either that their new mansion, quote unquote, their zvul, is now in Sheol, where they will decompose, because that's what the Hebrew there means, right? Yibolu, or that term, means to wear out, to wear down. Okay, it's used about the Israelites. Moses's song at the end of Devarim, that when they walked through the desert, their sandals did not wear out. It was a sign of God's protection in the desert. So here too, the opposite. Their form, their shape, will fall apart, the body. And either it means in their new mansion, meaning Sheol. Remember, these are the guys who lived in the big house, if you will, Tybel, the fools who lived in the big house, right? And yeah, you're going to live in the big house down below, where your body's going to rot. Not that your name will be known forever. Or he says, me, the mem, can mean they were taken from their mansions into this place to decompose. Okay? So it's a very, very powerful statement here of what really is going to happen. But then comes verse 16. This is the problematic verse. Let's look at it. Ach. Now here's another ach. And here it means, however. Elohim yifden nafshi miyad sheol. God will save my nefesh, my life, from sheol. Okay? Ki kacheni, selah. Because he will take me. Selah. Another selah. Okay? These guys are going to go down. But I, he's making now a contrast. I, however, am not going to go to hell, so to speak. God will take me. What the heck is he talking about? Michael.
Well, maybe in this case, at this point, nefesh does mean soul rather than body.
And it doesn't mean body anywhere. It's a life force. It means himself. It means that he will be, the way it concludes is, it's not just his soul. We don't know where the souls are. It says he will be taken. All it says is, here's, nafshi means me.
Mm.
Him. Okay? The notion of the soul.
Me being, rather than my soul.
There's nowhere in the Bible that we find the concept of God taking up a soul. It's not biblical.
Okay. But I thought that the theory was that you say Kaddish for the departed for a period of time to elevate their soul. That's what this was referring to.
That's rabbinic. But this is not biblical. Mm-hmm. Don't find that in the Bible. Kaddish doesn't exist in the Bible. You know that. It's a rabbinic tradition. I mean, the rabbis articulated it. How old it was, I don't know. But the rabbis articulated it. Remember, Kaddish was not said, had nothing to do with death until the Middle Ages. The first time Rambam and the Machzor Vitri, Rambam in the 12th century, 13th century, Machzor Vitri, 12th century, Vitri, France. So Sfarim and Ashkenazim know nothing about Mourner's Kaddish. So it couldn't have been here. But here's the question, or the suggestion. Let me finish this up. I see hands. Hold on. Wait. Look at the wording. It's Elohim Yikacheni. God will take me. Is there another place in the Bible where Elohim takes someone? I'm looking at the wording. Elohim Yikacheni. God will take me. Where God takes someone. All right, Rick, I see Tybel maybe wants to answer that. I'm going to take her.
Tybel. Is it Enoch?
Yes, good. Oh, you got it. Turn to Genesis chapter 5. My goodness, Tybel, you get 2 gold stars tonight.
Good, because I've pierced ears, one in each ear, and only one. I couldn't wear it nicely.
What's the verse in chapter 5?
24. Elohim takes him. It's the only place. Now, we know Elijah the prophet was taken up. But it does, first of all, it's Adonai in that story. And secondly, actually, he took an Uber up. God did not personally take him. Maybe it was a Lyft. Ah, a Lyft, of course, up, got it. No, I mean, this flaming chariot came down. God was not driving it and took him up. He got a transport. That's not what this is saying. This is like Enoch, like Hanoch. Hanoch will take me up. I like that. God will take me up. God will take me. Okay? Now, because of this, Hanoch became morphed into the leading angel in heaven, Metatron. That's in the ancient mystical sources of Judaism. Hanoch became the senior angel in heaven. Okay. All right. So, I think that may be what that means. My point, the reason why this conclusion, I haven't seen anybody who actually, Benji does allude to that. He does. He mentions that and he mentions Elijah the prophet. But I would agree with that the Elijah the prophet is a little bit off base But the reference to Chanuch is spot on. And that means that this is a concept used rarely, three times if you want to include Eliyahu. But I don't think that's what this is based on. I think this is based on the story, on this, what happened to Chanuch. And that's this notion that God, three times only, physically took a body. And that's why, Mike, that's what we're talking about here. He physically took the body with the soul in it up to heaven. Now, it's not a fundamental principle yet, but those are the only times. And they didn't die. In each case, they were all alive. That's the point. They don't die. Okay. Rick.
Hi. I wanted to bring us back to verse 8 there, where you were playing with Ach, brother with a chet, or Ach with a final chaf. So there, it's Ach lo fado yivde ish. You can't redeem a man, or the evil people aren't redeeming each other, however you want to translate that. But here, Ach Elohim yivde nafshi. And I think it's a positive kind of statement here that God does take our soul up, and that's the way I'd like to read that.
Only me.
Yeah, sure.
Not me.
me, myself, my soul. Right. It says it in Art Scroll.
No,
redeem
right.
My soul.
It's like Enoch, like Chanuch. The whole package goes up alive. That's what this is talking about. He doesn't go down, right? God will redeem me from Sheol and take me
right.
up.
It's
he went down and he took him out from there. He never went down. He redeemed him. If you redeem someone, the whole point was, the whole discussion here is that the rich person can somehow buy off God and not have to go down. He did not even have to buy. He didn't have to do anything. God picked him up, took him up. That's the point. Never went down. If you go down, you don't come up. It's either or. That's the whole concept here. All right, Tybel. But thank you. The ox. No, you're right. You're absolutely, I didn't even think of that. The echo here is with Padut. It's with redemption. They think this. They're wrong. I know that I'm going up. Now, the point is, who does he think he is? Right? I don't know. That's the one thing we don't know. He has not said anything about himself, other than the fact he wasn't afraid. Now you know why he wasn't afraid in verse 6 of the bad times that he faced. He wasn't afraid because he was sure that God was going to take him up. This is a response to verse 6 also.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I like it a lot. Yeah.
That's what it is. See that? So, I mean, my thought on that simply was that this is a guy who was not rich. He didn't operate with the same set of values as these people. Remember, he associates wealth with evil. He was a decent person. He says, I don't go around doing that. I don't yell and say, I'll be here all the time. This house is mine. It's my future. My presence will always be here. And I don't bring evil into the world the way those guys do. All right? So I can rest assured that I will not. Maybe he really believes that he's going to be taken up. He doesn't say, I'm the only one. He says, speaking for myself. He goes back to his very personal self and says, I'm not that. I guess I believe I'll be taken up. Now, you may say that's a little bit of hubris on his part, which is really not consistent with a humble person. All right? Could be. I don't know. But you see that it sticks out like a sore thumb here. So, there are, and as Benji mentioned, there are dozens of explanations. Some even say that he was the bad guy who's mentioned up above. He was the fool. but he changed his ways. Well, how do we know that? It doesn't say that. The implication here is the fool can't change his ways. He doesn't want it because he believes it. He's the cat's meow. Tybalt.
So, and it's even stronger if one looks at his patronymic, because he's Enoch Chanoch ben Yared, the son of the one who goes down, then is the one who goes up.
That's interesting.
And because we don't know much about him. We just know how long he lived and blah, blah, this. And it's in, anyway, and if I can sneak the other thing in, when the one verse made me think of 30, and I think it's actually 6, not 5, when I looked, the joy comes in the morning. In verse 4, it talks about Shaul. So there it's down in the pit and Shaul in the end of life, and 2 verses later, it's joy comes in the morning.
Uh-huh. Very interesting. Okay. All right. Moving on. Al-Tirak, now he's saying, sharing more wisdom. Al-Tirak, do not fear. Ki Asher Ish, if a guy gets rich, ki Yirbe Kvod Beito, that he fills his, do not fear when a person becomes rich, when his household goods increase, when his kvod, the honor, it's kvod, I would say here, not honor, but the heaviness, kaved, it's heavy. Right? His house becomes heavy with goods. All right? Don't be afraid. Why? Ki lo b'motoy yikach hakol. For when he dies, he's not going to take any of it along. Lo yered acharav kavodo. All his goods are not going to follow him down. Right? It's sort of repetitive. But he's saying it here very clearly. This is the conclusion. The ultimate message that came out of all of his discussion about the fool and about rich people, what they believe and so forth and so on. He says, in sum, summary statement here, this is what, don't be, so you see how the guy got rich? Don't let it bother you. He ain't taking it with him. Plain and simple. Now, moving now, he's getting a get more poetic. 19 and 20. Another dyad. Ki nafsho b'chayav yibarech. Right. Though he praises his soul in his lifetime, but he praises his soul, praises himself, right? Nafsho, meaning himself. He praises himself, he blesses himself, praises himself when he's alive. Then this is what he says to himself. It's he is mevarech himself. He praises himself while he's living. Colon. And this is what he said. For you are acknowledged when you do well for yourself. The Yoducha, they praise you. Ki teitiv lach, when it's good, when things are good for you, right? He says, you see, I got a lot of stuff. They praise me. Ah, that's wonderful. That's the type of guy this is. All right? Why? Because Tavo Ador Abotav. Okay. His nephesh, okay, must join the generation of his ancestors. Now you see that nephesh means that whatever it is going down. But I think nephesh again could also mean himself. But the point here is it's going down. I see your hand. Just a second, Mike. Okay. Because he is going to go down where his parents are. What is that? Ad netzach lo yiru or. Forever, they will never see light. In other words, he's going down. His essence is going down into a dark place where his body will decompose. Like his parents. No different. That's the end. All right. Mike.
To quote Tevye, when you're rich, they think you really know.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yes. Now, final statement. Adam bikar b'lo yavin, nimshal k'behemot nivnu. All right. Instead of loyalin, right? He doesn't go down with all this stuff, right? It means Adam bikar, a person is loaded, the loyavin, and he doesn't understand because he's a fool. Tybal, he's a fool. He doesn't say it, but you can see this is a rich man. Mike, you just said, people think he knows a lot. What he's saying is, no, he's a dumb fool. Okay, this rich guy, right? He doesn't understand. What doesn't he understand? Nimshal kaveni mot nidmu. He's like the animals. They die. They fall apart. That's the end. Period. Same with him. He made his point. This is said in the house of mourning, right, during Shiva. Why? I think I briefly mentioned this at the beginning. Is this an upbeat? Is this a psalm that comforts you? I don't think it comforts.
Verse 16 does, but that's all.
Yeah, but it's not going to happen to you. God's not going to take you up like that. Not like Hanoh, right? Not like Hanoh. You could argue that. But now that you understand, though, that Yikach, it's the same verb. It's the exact same verb that when he took him up. That's him and Eliyahu, and not necessarily you. Okay, you're more like what happened with the last verse says. You're going to do what your fathers did. You're going to end up the same place. Now, if they were righteous people, means your neshama will go up. That's good. Okay, but that's not what this is saying. Okay, all right, Bert.
I think it says in Pirkei Avot or somewhere else in the Talmud, you shouldn't try and comfort someone when they're standing over the grave. And this
is not set over the grave, though. This is when you get home for the Shiva.
Okay. But I'm just talking about when you recognize that somebody needs a space in which to mourn. And so the only reason I can figure for including this in a house of mourning is it does relate to the sorrow that people feel. And it doesn't say, no, it really was nothing. Everything's going to be okay.
Right.
It really says, I understand. It really is horrible.
Yes.
And so from there, which I think part of what came out of all of these psalms that you've been teaching is they're human. They're very, very human. We're not quite sure who wrote the Torah. I mean, some people are, some people aren't. Exactly who. We pretty much know that the Psalms were written by men.
Yeah.
And they were not written to be religion. They were written to express the kind of feelings that we all have. So from that standpoint, it makes sense to me this would be used in a house of mourning. But it certainly is not it's not uplifting.
That's right.
I don't think it is.
It's not comforting, but
No, but I don't think that's the intention.
Right, okay.
Mike. Sometimes people need just to be heard, you know what? It is terrible.
Yeah, Mike.
Yeah, I think that implicit in this is that it's saying the rich and the poor alike are going to die. It's the way of the world, and don't be angry at God because of it.
Yeah, so, I think you're both right. I think you're both right. I think if that was pointed out to me by a layperson, I think I mentioned this when I was gave a Dvar Torah about this before I really understood fully. I mean, this was within the year that passed, you know, maybe 10, 12 months ago. I talked about this, but I hadn't studied it like this. And I think that that's the point. In other words, what this person mentioned was we are at a home. We are all together. It's warm. It's comforting, right? The people are surrounded by love. And this is said to remind them exactly what both of you said, that you lost, somebody died. They were buried in the ground. They're not coming back physically. Physically, you will not see them again. You've got to accept that. And we're here to help you accept that. Okay. In other words, our comforting. We're here to comfort you. Yes. And we want to make your pain go away or help you reduce it. Yes. But don't forget, don't assume that every life is hunky-dory. There's a hole in your life right now. A loved one is gone. And accept it. And we grieve with you on that. And you're going to feel grief, and don't expect it to go away right away. All right. It's a mixture. It brings reality into what can be a very warm, I don't say seductive, but a very nice place to be. All my friends are here. We break bread together, whatever. This is nice. It's nice, but don't diminish the loss. Yeah. All right, on that happy note, Yishar Koach to everybody.
Thank you, Rabbi.
You are the purpose. No, you are the results of this. I have learned a huge amount by your questions, by our discussion, by the reading that I did, the thinking. But the fact is that you pushed me. I felt that I had to keep this at a very high level, because that's what you guys needed and deserved. And I'm very grateful for the fact that you got it. I mean, I'm not saying that everything, all the interpretations that we shared are the interpretations. As you see, some of these things are very obscure and it's difficult to know for sure. And if you come up, and you guys have suggested to me in the process a number of things that I didn't notice, and I thank you for that. And I hope that I opened your eyes to some stuff that you never noticed. That's good.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am, Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.